Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone, and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have an amazing, an amazing guest, someone that has gone from the operator side now to the investment side very successfully. So, and we're going to be talking about all the good stuff that you are all dealing with, whether it is how to think about fundraising, how to build your team and the management team, and what's important when you do so, product market fit, what does that look like? And then also how to think about outcomes, for companies, which I think that that's essential because always the end, the beginning needs to start with the end in mind, and how you reverse back engineer to where you are right now. So again, a very inspiring conversation in front of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Michael Marks. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So originally born and raised in Missouri. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Well, it's funny. I always like to say the Midwest is a good place to be from. I mean, it was a wonderful place to grow up, community and all that sort of stuff. Very different from the way I live today in Silicon Valley, which is, just high energy, lots of new things happening, all kinds of cool people. I mean, so it was a bit quieter in the Midwest growing up.
So how was that transition from psychology to the world of business? That's quite the shift.
Well, like a lot of people in college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and psychology was interesting to me. It just wasn't really much of a profession to get into. So like a lot of people, I went to business school to get some real training, broader training, so that I could have a lot of other opportunities. And that worked out great.
So what was that moment in time? Obviously, you do the MBA in Harvard, and I'm sure that day opened up your eyes, to the world of business. But what was that moment where you realized, hey, I need to pack the bags and go to Silicon Valley? I mean, you already had family at that point, so I'm sure that was not an easy decision.
No, it wasn't. And it's funny, I was in St. Louis. My kids were young. I was 37. I had been working in small technology companies, which is all there was in St. Louis, and is the case in most of the Midwest. And, my customers were in Silicon Valley. Some of our employees were there. And, we just said, look, we're adults. We have a choice. Why don't we just go where the action is for the kinds of stuff that I'm interested in? And, a lot of our friends said, what are you doing? You don't have a job. You're just leaving. And I go, look, I mean, it's just an adventure. We can always come back. And it turned out to be a pretty good adventure.
So then let's talk about that adventure, because you land there in Silicon Valley without a job, doing consulting. How does that transition into, getting to work for other companies and being part of that Silicon Valley, ecosystem?
Well, it's a good question. It's just so much fun to be an entrepreneur in Silicon Valley because, what I tell people, one of the differences between the Midwest and being in Silicon Valley is that in the Midwest, if somebody would make an introduction, you should go meet this person, people don't really do it because it's not interesting. It doesn't lead to anything. In the Bay Area, people are making introductions and everybody does it because your paths are interwoven and you're always meeting in different places. And so just meeting people turns out to be something that is very reinforcing for the climate for the business climate. And it was just fantastic. And so it was easy for me to get jobs. I mean, I knew some people there and they would introduce me to other people and say, hey, why don't you come and do some work over here? And it was just so energizing. I just had a smile on my face every day.
So then at what point, because I think that Flextronics, was a pivotal moment for you, right? And you ended up going and working for them. But how did the whole idea of being and working there to then all of a sudden having an opportunity to buy, the company? I mean, that's quite the sequence of events there, Michael.
Well, it is. And thanks for asking that question, because I think for your listeners, there's a good message here, which is, being prepared for the moment when you can, really take action is important, and then taking it when the time comes. So the story was, I moved to Silicon Valley. I did had a consulting project at Flextronics, and I had a consulting project at Electronic Arts, and both of them offered me full-time jobs. So I took the Flextronics job, and I was a plant manager there for a year. And the company was struggling, and I still had this offer on the table to go to Electronic Arts. So I went over there for a year, which was really fantastic. I was then asked, Flextronics is a relatively small company, and through a series of events, they asked me to join the board. So I was actually on the board of Flextronics while I was off running a small company. Then I took a three-year gig running a company called Metcal. But I was on the board of Flextronics, and what happened was the company was struggling. The banks were that had the loans were planning to sell the company to you know, recover their loans. And I asked them what they were going to sell it for, and they said $8.5 million. So then I went and raised money from Sequoia and Kleiner Perkins and NEA, and raised the $8.5 million. And we bought 55% of the company, and then I was installed as the CEO. And it was just an opportunity in time. I was there. I knew the company. I knew the management team. They wanted me to be the leader at that point, and I just went for it. I mean, literally, when the banks told me what they were going to do, I resigned from the board the next day so I wouldn't be in a conflict, and then put together a group that bought control of it. Look, when we did that, this was a relatively small company. It's $90 million of revenue, but in the manufacturing space, that's not a lot of revenue. That's actually a small amount. That would be a lot in the software business. But we, you know, my idea then was to build it up to a couple $100 million and sell it and move on. And through a series of you know, very, you know, lucky, fortuitous events, we got the opportunity to stay and play. We became a public company. And when I left in 2005, it was $25 billion. So it was quite a ride, but it was unexpected.
No kidding. Now, for how long were you involved with the business when the opportunity comes for you to put the group of investors and strike a deal?
Yeah, so I had worked there full-time for a year, and then I'd been on the board for 3 years. So I knew the company pretty well at that point. And then the opportunity came just because the banks decided they were going to move in and take over.
And why was that going to be the case?
Because the company was struggling, and there wasn't a view towards a good outcome for the banks. Like, how am I ever going to get paid back? So they just wanted to go sell their stock, take, you know, they had stock and security for the loan, and they just wanted to take over the stock and then go sell it and get their money out and move on.
So how did the conversation unfold? You know, I mean, obviously you were not a deal maker up until that point, right? But here you are all of a sudden, you know, structuring things, getting the deal to happen and buying, you know, that piece of the company. So walk us through how those, you know, events unfolded, you know, until the transaction finally gets
sure.
finished.
Sure. Well, so what happened was I was on the board. So it was a small group of board members, and some of the board members were in Asia because at that point the company's headquarters were in Singapore and the operations were all in Asia. The bank was in Wisconsin, and so, you know, they called. I was in the U.S. and I met with them, and they said, look, we don't see a good outcome here. We just want to take over, you know, convert our debt into the equity of the company. We have the right to do that. It's 55% of the company. And then we're going to sell our stock. And I said, well, what are you going to sell it for? And they said $8.5 million, because that's how much they were owed. And I said, okay, I'll be back to you. And then I thought that was going to be a fantastic opportunity. I knew a bunch of the venture capitalists in the Valley. So I resigned from the board. I went to visit the, you know, these venture capitalists and said, $8.5 million, we can have 55% ownership of this company, and that'll be a steal. We can really make something out of it. And so, you know, I was able to raise the money. And then I went back to the banks and said, we're just going to pay you we're going to take over the 55% of the stock. We'll pay you the $8.5 million. I was installed as the CEO. The bank went away, and then we just started running the business. And it was a great moment in time. And you're asking a really good question, because, you know, When an entrepreneur gets an opportunity and knows how to deal with it, I'd already worked at the company, so I understood the business. And here was an opportunity to get in and have a real equity stake for not very much money. And I'd already gotten to know some of these venture firms because of my time at Electronic Arts, because they were invested in Electronic Arts. That's how I knew them. And they just said, you know, seems like a good guy, did a good job at Electronic Arts, decided to back me, and, you know, the rest is history, as they said.
That's unbelievable. So what was the value of the company when the transaction happened?
Was $8.5 million for 55%, so roughly $15 million for the value of the company.
And then when you turned chapter, you know, it was $25 billion. So that's quite the ride, Michael. So what do you think? Well, What do you think needed to happen, you know, for that incredible rocket ship to, you know, from a company that is struggling to all of a sudden it gets transformed into a rocket ship and it goes all the way to 25 billion? I mean, what were the key ingredients that allowed for that journey to happen?
Yeah, so this is one of those times where one of those things where you say, you know, better to be lucky than good. I got involved in that business at a time when the industry was taking off, which is not the way it is today. Today, it's very mature. You know, so this is 1993, when most companies did their own manufacturing. You know, today, nobody does their own manufacturing. So we were in the forefront of a great opportunity. And entrepreneurs, you know, need to always be looking at that, as we call product market fit, which we can get into later. But the fact is, companies were looking to get out of manufacturing, and we were just in the early stages of that. Now, that having been said, that's opportunity. There's lots of big markets in the world, and we got the opportunity to get into Flextronics, but there was a lot of execution involved, and we can go talk about what that's about. But in terms of building a management team, it was a global company. When I left, we had factories in 26 countries. That is not easy work. But we had the opportunity. The market opportunity was there. And so we're in the right place at the right time. That having been said, we had to be very aggressive in driving costs down and increasing our services to the customers to get permission to continue to grow. And fortunately, we were able to do that. It was a huge success.
So then obviously, you know, you build it up to 25 billion, remarkable journey. At what point do you decide, you know, the chapter is coming to an end and it's time to turn page?
Well, that's another good question. Thanks for that one. You know, and we have our own podcast called Tech Surge, and I interviewed recently Indra Nooyi, who was the CEO of Pepsi. She did very much like me, went out on the top. And one of the things we talked about that is that, you know, companies management gets stale. I was the CEO for 13 years. I think Indra was 12 years. It was very similar. But you get to the place where you need new ideas and fresh ideas. And the way you get that is by taking younger people who have different ideas, because the tools change. We all know, just look at cell phones. It didn't, you know, even exist, you know, back when I started Flextronics, and the way information is ubiquitous and all kind of stuff. So it takes younger people who have a different view to keep a company growing. And, you know, I was 55, and it wasn't the end of my career by any means. You know, I've gone on to do all these other things, but I really felt it was that I was getting stale. I tell a story about this. You know, I went to Davos for 4 years and, you know, I was on, you know, panels with, you know, important people and blah, blah. And, you know, when my marketing manager came to me and said, it's time to plan your trip to Davos again this year, that was the moment I decided it was time to move on, because I didn't want to go to Davos again. I'd already done that. And I wanted the CEO of the company to be excited about doing that. And I had a great chief operating officer, and it was time to hand over the reins. And people would say to me, you're too young to retire. And I go, I'm not dying. I'm just going to go do some other things. And it's turned out great.
Well, one of those other things was becoming the interim CEO of Tesla. And what a exciting chapter. I mean, what Tesla has become today is absolutely unbelievable. But how did that happen?
Well, one of the Flextronics executives went over to Tesla, was running R&D over there, and said, you ought to come and see this company. This was before there was even a car, right? It was very early days. And so I went over and visited. It seemed kind of cool. And I put some money in it. I had a little sort of a private venture fund that I'd started. I put some money in it and you know, was hanging out over there. I got to know Elon. You know, he used to stay with me when he was coming up to visit from Southern California. And he really wanted more professional operating management, which I was not in a position to do because I had started this growth capital firm, Ripplewood Capital. But he asked me if I would step in for a few months, which I did. And I had a pretty big impact. He acknowledges that. But by no means do I want to lead any of your listeners to believe that I'm in the ballpark with Elon Musk. I mean, that's a brilliant guy who pushed the envelope in so many directions. And I couldn't be more excited for what he's done for the world, honestly.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So, I mean, here you are, an operator that decides to go to the other side of the table, to the investment side. So what I would say triggered, you know, that transition?
Well, you know, I was really, you know, I had a lot of connections in the world because of Flextronics. I mean, I had friends all over the world and friends in high places and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I thought I was just planning to, when I retired from Flextronics, just to be a personal, you know, investor like many people do, you know, after having had a successful career. And I got recruited to join KKR, which I was not planning on that. I didn't know if that was something I wanted to do. It was, you know, the headquarters out in Silicon Valley was very close to where I lived. I go, why don't I give it a try? You know, and I did that. I didn't find it particularly interesting for me because in these very large buyouts and subsequently at Riverwood, you know, it's more financial management, which just wasn't that interesting to me. I'm an operator. And as I have moved into the venture business, that's way more interesting for me because there's so much operating, so many operating issues that it takes to try to create a valuable company. When you're buying a giant company, you know, you're just doing financial management. Nothing wrong with that. I'm not being critical of that. It just didn't fit me as an operator. I wanted to spend more time working directly with entrepreneurs, working with companies that are just getting started, help them figure out product market fit, help them figure out how to do management teams. And I love it. It's great.
So obviously that ended up getting you into what you're doing now, which is Celesta Capital, which was right. The spinoff of Riverwood. But on Celesta, you know, tell us about Celesta. What are you all doing at Celesta? What companies are you excited about? What's really the purpose, you know, that gets you guys, you know, out of bed every morning?
Well, thanks for asking that question because I'm really, really excited about it. So happy to answer that one. We're an unusual firm because the four general partners have all had big operating jobs. So, you know, I ran Flextronics, as we just discussed. Nick Brathwaite, one of my partners, was the chief technology officer at Flextronics. Sriram Viswanathan, our other partner, ran a big operating business at Intel and then was instrumental in the starting of Intel Capital. And the fourth one, Matt Marsh, was our CFO, was the CFO of a publicly traded company. So we're an unusual group of characters. We're also older, and we are very hands-on in our companies. Each one of us has been CEO of one of our companies at a time when we needed to step in. What's exciting about what we're doing and different from the others, first of all, the results in the venture business have not been very good of late. There's a lot of articles being written, you know, the results aren't very good. And part of the reason for that is that the venture firms have gotten really large. And in fact, all the companies have gotten really large, the growth capital companies, you know, the KKR and TPGs of the world. And when people have lots of money, they have to do really big deals. And venture, as it was always constructed, is smaller deals. And if you have a $10 billion fund, you're not in the venture business anymore, because you can't put $10 million in a company and hope for a $100 million return, because you have to return $30 billion. That doesn't do anything for you. We've stayed small. What's differentiated about us, and part of the reason our results are, you know, all of our results are top quartile and top decile in a couple of the funds, is because we're hardware guys. You know, we did all this hardware work. We did it in Flextronics, And, you know, everybody started thinking that hardware is capital intensive and software is not. Everybody should go do software. In the last 25 or 30 years, it's all been about software, which, by the way, is very capital intensive. It's just a different kind of use of capital because it takes a lot of money. If you're in the enterprise software business, it takes lots of capital to, you know, to build these companies. So here we are doing semiconductor deals and, you know, and storage deals and data center activities and so on. And all of a sudden, AI comes along. It explodes on the scene. And what's happening is, of course, there's lots of great software things to do in AI. But what it turns out is that artificial intelligence, in order to use it, takes so much computing power that the entire hardware system in the world now has to get remade, which is why, you know, the most valuable company, the top companies in the world are, you know, NVIDIA is a hardware company. Like, gosh, I knew Jensen, you know, loved the guy. Knew him when he had, you know, 15 people in Santa Clara in a little office trying to design, you know, graphics processing units. And now it's like the most valuable company in the world. It's like, awesome. I send him text once in a while because I see him on TV. He's become so famous. But we had this group of people, Hock Tan at Broadcom, you know, Sanjay Mehrotra at Micron. I just had him on one of our podcasts as well. And now the entire hardware system has to get remade because it uses too much power and is too expensive. And so, gosh, it is, you talk about a target-rich environment for an investor. And so you ask the question, what are we excited about? We have two processor companies, Auradine and Recogni. Both will likely be public companies before too long, you know, that are exploding on the scene. We have all kind. We have a company that Stathera that makes a timing chip, you know, at a hundredth of the cost and a hundredth of the power, and so on. There's opportunities everywhere, and there's so much demand. So when you talk about product market fit, I mean, right now everybody is in the market for products that run faster and use less power, and so we're just kids in a candy store right now. It's just really fun.
So how many investments have you done, and what's the assets under management right now of Celesta Capital?
We have about 70 active companies. We had about 100 altogether. We've exited 30 or so. And we've had some wonderful exits lately. We had two. We had a public offering in India and one in the United States in the last, you know, 18 months. It's been great. So, yeah, we have a lot of companies. We probably have too many. We need to shrink it down a bit and put more heft behind some of them. But part of that's because the opportunity has gotten so big, Alejandro. I mean, when you look at you know, processor companies, we have this one company, Auradine. You know, it's 2 years old. We already have $400 million of orders. That's pretty unusual for a venture investment.
No kidding. Now, obviously, you know, to that point too, let's double click on product market fit. You know, what does product market fit look like, and what kind of advice do you have for the founders listening?
Well, thanks for that question. It's really important, Alejandro, for founders, because, you know, we look at deals all the time, and companies very frequently do not have product market fit. What it means to have product market fit is that whatever it is you're going to create or you're in the business of creating, there is clear demand for it. There is an ability to stand out from competition, and that you bring the right skill sets to make that fit. Let me give you an example of how, because I tell entrepreneurs this all the time. I meet them and they always go, the market is X, and they always overstate the size of the market. In fact, you know, one of my little quips is I say the three mistakes entrepreneurs make is they overestimate the size of their market, they overestimate the amount of it that they can get, and they underestimate what it's going to cost them to get it. And I'm giving this speech to entrepreneurs all the time, which is, let's use the most, you know, the most well-known example in the world is Tesla Motors. Okay, so if Tesla says, my market opportunity is, and then they defined the entire auto business, that isn't true. Because they're making, you know, they come into the market with a relatively high cost electric vehicle. The market isn't the entire auto industry. The market is which customers are going to pay more than they could for another car and have an electric vehicle, which means they have to have a charger in their garage and all kind of stuff. It is very, very classic for entrepreneurs to say, my market is the whole market, which it never is. It's always some subset. So what I always talk to entrepreneurs is when you're looking at your product market fit, so what is your product and what market can it truly address? Let's not get overly excited. Let's not say we can address, you know, we're going to do financial software. Your opportunity isn't every bank in the world, because that can't possibly be the case. So it's very important for entrepreneurs to organize their thinking around a smaller market that they can be a player in, and not try to take on, you know, not try to take on a huge industry, because they can't. They're small. So this is very important, and done poorly a lot of times. So that's how I think about product market.
So what about fundraising? You know, because right now, obviously, we've gone through the motions, through different cycles, different markets. So obviously, one thing is to get product market fit, and then the other one is to support, you know, growth, you know, as you continue to go with the business. So how should founders think about fundraising?
Well, this is a really important one, and this is another speech that I give all the time. Entrepreneurs, when they're raising capital, first of all, this is a very tough time to raise capital. It's a very tough time for companies to raise capital. It's a very tough time for funds like Celestia to raise capital. These are cycles. It's tough now because results have been bad, as we talked about earlier, in the fund size. And because there's been so few distributions, investors are not actively looking for companies to invest in. So it's a bit of a desert. What entrepreneurs get wrong all the time is that they get focused on how much money they want to raise and at what valuation. So the valuation, I tell entrepreneurs all the time, get the money. Get the money and don't worry about valuation. You know, over time, if you're successful, you know, you'll do up rounds. You can buy back stock if you want to, whatever it is. It is very important for entrepreneurs to be focused on not the valuation, but the cash. Get the cash. And it's hard for entrepreneurs because they have, you know, visions of sugar plums, as they say. You know, they want to be Mark Zuckerberg, and you can't be. When you're in an early stage, you have to take the money. And I see this all the time, Alejandro, honestly. I mean, on boards that I sit on, you know, where the next round, you know, the last round was at, you know, 80 million, the new round has to be at 150. And I go, why does that be at 150? Why shouldn't it just be at 80 or even at 50? Whatever it takes to get the money done. And because capital is necessary, but not sufficient. Obviously, you have to have capital run the business. The other thing that drives me crazy and is a recommendation that I give all the time is do not spend money on things that you don't need. It's amazing, these companies. I'll be sitting here with a, you know, burn rate of $2 million a month. And then the money starts to run out and they go, oh, crap, we have to cut costs. And all of a sudden it's $500,000 a month instead of $2 million. Well, what took them so long? You know, it's like, why don't we run the companies as efficiently as possible with as little money as it takes to be getting their product ready for market. And it's amazing how lean companies get when they have to, right, before they go out of business. So I'm always preaching that. Get the money at whatever price it takes and run the business as efficiently as possible from the first day.
Well, as they say, money in comes with expectations of money out with returns. So how should founders also think about outcomes and exits and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, that's important. And it goes to some of the other things we've already talked about. Like, you know, what's the size of the market we're trying to address and how do we get to be successful there? It is very unusual, rare. It's not unusual, I guess, isn't the right word, but rare would be the right word for companies to go public. And so, you know, if you happen to get into a business like at Flextronics, we got lucky, we got to be big enough, all of a sudden the IPO market was an opportunity. But most companies are going to get sold. And it goes back to thinking about what is the business we're trying to create here? How do we dominate a sector? And you really want to, if you're a small company, you want to dominate a smaller sector. Because when you do, you become a very attractive acquisition candidate. So then the big companies can go and say, okay, these guys, you know, dominate this sector. And we're the big guys. We have big sales, you know, sales engines, and we spend a lot of money on marketing, and we can turn this company into a very big company. And that's how most companies, that's what most exits look like. And the big companies know that they're not very innovative, that they have to create an innovation by, you know, by buying up companies that are small and quick and are forward thinking. And that's generally the way it should be done. And it goes right back to capital raising and product market fit, which is, what are we trying to accomplish here? What we're trying to do is build a business that has a really nice market opportunity. We have good growth in the opportunity. And at the right point in time, a bigger company is most likely going to come along and make us part of their business.
So, Michael, you go to sleep tonight, okay, and you have the snooze of a lifetime. And you wake up in a world where the vision of Celesta Capital is fully realized. What does that world look like?
You know, you ask good questions, unusual questions. I've been asked that one. You know, what we live and breathe, Alejandro, is building successful companies that we can be proud of. You know, I did my share to make Flextronics a successful company. I've been gone for nearly 20 years now. I still like to look at the stock and see that they're doing well, and they're doing really well over there. You know, I had my little bit in Tesla, inched it forward, and now it's become this big, successful company. We have wonderful companies at Celesta. Some have gone public. We had Credo, which went public last year, has done really, really well. We had a company we're very excited about, Idea Forge in India, that went public about 9 months ago, very successful. We're proud of these things. It's not the money. We don't get up in the morning and go, how do I make more money? It's like I get up every morning going, how do I help these companies be more successful and have really, and you know, create great jobs and have, you know, entrepreneurs who've been successful. That's what really drives us. And, you know, I've had a big career. I'm not trying to create some big new career. I'm trying to get these companies to take advantage of what I know how to do. And that goes for my partners and our other investors. You know, how do we make these companies successful and turn into things we can be proud of? That's really what drives us.
So, Michael, let's talk about the past now, because obviously, you know, we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past with a lens of reflection. I'm going to bring you, you know, in a time machine, and I'm going to bring you back in time all the way back to, let's say, 1992. You are at the boardroom where now is being discussed, you know, with the banks, you know, what's going on, and the idea, you know, comes to mind of potentially doing a deal. Now you resign. And let's say you are on your way to meet with the Sequoias and everyone in Sand Hill Road. And right there, you know, while you're in the cab, you're able to sit down with that younger self. And let's say you're able to give that younger Michael one piece of advice before going at it, you know, now as a CEO, as a founder too. What would you tell that younger self? What would be that one piece of advice that you would give to that younger self before embarking in the journey?
Be fearless. Be curious. Be open to ideas. Listen to these other people. You're going to talk to the Sequoias and NEAs, the Kleiners of the world. They know things I don't know. I shouldn't go in there going like, I have all the answers. I need to go in there and go, I have an idea, but I am open to any ideas you have of how I can most likely be more successful. I'll relate a story that happened later in life that is the advice I would have given to myself younger. I had a guy in my office from Dell, and I was asking him how they manage some logistics thing. And he goes through this whole thing, puts it on the board, draws it all out, and he turns to me and he goes, so that's how we do it, unless you have a better idea. And I've never forgotten that in my life. And so if I were giving that advice to myself on my way over to Sequoia, is my ideas are good ideas because they're my ideas, but surely they will have ideas that will make me better. And I need to be open to that. That's the advice I would give.
Love it. So Michael, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
You know, I am very open. So Marks, M-A-R-K-S at celesta.vc. My phone number is 408-209-6967. Send me a text. I am real time. Answer everything.
Wow. Easy enough. Well, hey, Michael, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Well, the honor is all mine. Thank you for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.